This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's the return of the band The Something Brothers. Ed Pierce says it wasn't a tough choice to do a new CD.
When you look each other in the eye and say, do you really want to do this? And everyone's kind of saying, yeah, I kind of want to do this. Then it's a lot easier than having a bunch of people just saying, maybe. There was no maybe.
John Norton reports on the band's first album in some decades. Plus, the After Hours Barbershop Quartet finished in third place at the international competition last year. This year, the Central Illinois-founded group won it all. Listen again to Laura Kennedy's profile of the quartet and its sweet harmonies. And it's time to scrap the gas-powered lawn tools for electric ones. Hear more on GLT's Grow. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Beside you, still you're not alone. No one is alone, truly no one is alone.
Last year, the Barbershop Quartet After Hours finished third in the International Quartet Competition. This song, No One Is Alone, is from that performance. This year, the group, founded in Central Illinois with one singer still from Tremont, is the Global Champion Quartet. Let's hear Laura Kennedy's feature about After Hours once again.
The group is called After Hours. Tim Beitel sings tenor in the Barbershop Quartet. His day job involves music, too, as a public school music teacher in Morton. And if you think barbershop is just for squares and old folks, Beitel says that's just not so. He says a cappella music is experiencing a resurgence in the 21st century.
Singing has just been out there a lot more, kind of in the public eye, I think, which has helped. And then you've had groups like Pentatonix and some of these other, you know, a cappella groups that all of a sudden have just brought more recognition to a cappella music. Barbershop's kind of always been there in the background. It got started, the Society for Barbershop got started in 1938. So it's been there all along, but now you're seeing kind of this youth movement in barbershop because a cappella music is just being more widely accepted. So I was in high school and went to a youth and harmony festival here in Bloomington.
Yeah,
and
they're really good at outreach to young people.
Yeah, they are. And I had kind of been introduced to this one barbershop quartet called the Gas House Gang, and they were just this great quartet. I was not even really all that much into singing until I heard this quartet, actually. I heard my parents went to a show and brought home a CD, and I was like, that is amazing what that sounds like. So anyway, fast forward, I went to the Youth and Harmony Festival, and just started getting more and more into barbershop, had a high school quartet, went off to college and kind of met some new guys at college. And that's actually where After Hours got started. We were all students at Bradley University. And this was back in, 2008, probably. 2008 was when we first got together. And we were just, the four of us guys were just basically singing a song for a talent show that our chorale had there at the university, and we got together and
it just clicked.
Now actually there's only two of those four guys are still in the group, so it was kind of just four guys from the chorale. We sang a couple songs and really enjoyed it or whatever. Then as time went on, we found out more about kind of this barbershop world of competing and competitions and all that kind of extra stuff there. So as we got into the kind of the more competitive realm, I think we changed group members a couple times through the last 8-9 years here. But there's still actually the bass singer Dan and I are still original members from 2008 when we first got together. The other two guys, Drew and Brian, we met along the way through competition and through different circumstances, they joined the group.
So how would you describe, Tim, the sound of After Hours?
I mean, the typical barbershop sound compared to maybe other acapella styles, you're going to hear just really tight harmonies, okay? So acapella obviously means no instruments, and you're going to hear the lead voice, which is going to be more, I guess, if you're thinking in choral terms, like a second tenor kind of voice. The lead is going to always, for the most part, sing the melody, and then you're going to have a voice, the tenor voice, which is what I sing, on top of that. A lot of times using the falsetto voice, the male falsetto voice, and then you have the baritone singer who kind of sings above the lead when the melody's low and below the lead when the melody's high, and then you have the bass singer, obviously, who sings the low note.
Light the candles, just light them up right, ice out, roll the rug up, it's today. It may not be anyone's birthday, though it's far from the first of the year. I know that this very minute has history in it. Was for the moment we're here. It's a time for making merry. And so I'm for making hay, making hay. To tune the grand up. Dance your shoes off, strike the band up, strike it up. It's today.
It's tight harmony, so it's not like some other acapella styles where it might be more spread out, or you might have, you know, kind of a typical choral thing where you have high to low as far as the parts go. You actually have the parts that cross more often because the harmonies are just tighter. So
how do you keep it straight? You're so tight.
Yeah, well, I think that for the four of us, we all read music. So we were all classically trained at Bradley and at different universities. So we kind of have some background there, just kind of, I guess, learning through doing it, through definitely there's an ear training element of it. Even though you can read the notes, there's a whole other element of blend and being able to not just sing your note, but being able to hear, you know, how it should fit into the chord and how you should tune it and all that kind of stuff like that. So there's definitely, at the higher level of barbershop, it can be a pretty complicated or takes a lot of work. So,
well, how much do you guys rehearse in a week?
That has changed through the years. Now we're a distance quartet. So actually,
wait a minute, what's a distance quartet?
When we all got together at Bradley, obviously we were rehearsing 3-4 times a week.
Because you're all on campus.
We were all on campus. Yeah, it was great. Now we're, you know, guys in our 30s with families. And a couple of the guys, our lead singer, Drew, he actually sings in the Voices of Liberty at Disney World. So he lives in Orlando. And then, and then our baritone, Brian, he's a manager of a Chipotle out in Dubuque, Iowa. And then our bass singer, Dan, is a choir teacher up in Freeport, up by Rockford. And then I'm the only one actually who's still in the area here.
Well, so how do you practice?
The further we've kind of gone, the higher up we've gotten in the competition, we get more performance opportunities through that. That's the big thing. So honestly, a lot of our rehearsal now comes when we have performances or gigs. You know, when we have a performance on a Saturday, we'll all fly in on a Friday, rehearse on Friday night, sing the show on Saturday, maybe rehearse a little on Sunday or whatever, and then head back out. So we kind of try to make use of our performances as also kind of being our practice time as well.
So tell me about those performance opportunities. What are you doing? Are you singing in concerts, in weddings?
Well, I would say that 90% of our performances are for barbershop chapters. So there's barbershop choruses and chapters all around the U.S. and even in other countries. And so a lot of our shows, each of these chapters will have their kind of yearly annual show, and they like to have a featured quartet as part of the show. So they'll call us up and hire us to come out and be kind of the featured quartet on their show. I would say that's 90% of our performances. We also do have different opportunities where, you know, we'll be hired by different organizations for a special benefit or this or that, you know, where we'll do full concerts and things like that as well.
How many other quartets were you competing against?
There's over 1,000, probably 1,200-ish quartets
From
all over the world that compete in district contests or these preliminary contests. And you have to score a certain score out of 100, which is, I think the percentage is 76. If you score that percentage, then you can qualify for an international contest. So it took us actually a few years of being together till we even qualified. But only about 50 to 55 quartets out of those 1,200 qualify. for the international contest. And so then out of those 55 that make it, that score that 76 or better, they all come and you sing two songs. After the round one, the top 20 quartets move on, and then they sing two, you sing two new songs in round two. And then if you make it on to the top 10, you sing two new songs in the finals, which is the top 10. You know, it's been kind of a long journey for us. Like I said, you know, back when we started competing 7-8 years ago, we didn't qualify for international. So then we kind of, 5 years ago or so, we first qualified, and then we got 16th, and then we got 16th again, and 8th, and 8th, and 6th.
So you've just been climbing.
Yeah, we've been climbing. So the top five get a medal, which is kind of fairly significant in the barbershop world, is meddling. So our goal was really just to have a good time and make music and enjoy ourselves and, you know, let the chips fall where they fall. But I think we were all pretty excited to get a medal.
Well, so, what did it take for you to get from not even qualifying to getting 2 years
of work? And it's the cliche that a lot of barbershop quartets use, that it's all about the journey, and that there's a, but it's so true in a way, because throughout all these years, we've had different coaching sessions with prominent barbershop names and acapella, you know, coaches throughout the years. We've probably had upwards of 10 or more coaches. We've had a few who've been kind of our main coaches, but you learn songs and you get new songs and you try to find songs that fit your quartet identity. You know, that what is, you asked earlier in the interview, what is After Hours sound or whatever? And that's part of the journey, right? Is finding, okay, what type of songs fit our voices and fit our personalities.
Can you tell me about the songs that you choose?
That's been part of the journey, partially because a few years ago, we actually had our lead singer, who initially was a guy we had met at college, he had to leave the quartet. So we got a new lead singer, which getting a new singer of any other part is probably not as big of a deal. But when you get a new lead singer, mm-hmm. that really can change the identity of the quartet, because he's the guy who's out there singing the melody, really kind of telling the story of the song in a lot of ways. When we switched to Drew, our current lead singer, it took some time of trying all kinds of different songs to see, okay, look, what's After Hours with Drew now? The songs that we've kind of landed on lately that really have fit us, that I think helped us kind of make that next step, was actually songs a lot more kind of swing songs, some show tunes from like Broadway musicals and stuff like that. But I'm just kind of finding songs that are easy for us to be kind of relaxed, have a good time, easy singing kind of songs. So some of the songs we sang were, we sang a Mel Torme kind of You're a Heavenly Thing, which is a swing tune.
Baby, you stole this heart of mine, just like the stars, your eyes they shine. Your beauty always satisfies, and that's what makes you so divine. They took the moonlight out of the skies and put the moonlight right in your eyes,
like a dream. You're a heavenly thing,
baby, you're a heavenly thing.
And we sang a song from a musical called Catch Me If You Can, if you're familiar with that movie.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yes, yes, yes. There's a musical of it called Catch Me If You Can, and we sing the song Butter Out of Cream, which is kind of like the son, or the, I think it's like the father talking to the son, and it's one of the kind of like the themes throughout the story or whatever. That's the song we sang this year. We sang a song from Sweeney Todd called Not While I'm Around. We sang The Next 10 Minutes, which is from the last 5 years, so a couple Broadway tunes in there. So yeah, just, I mean, a variety of songs, but a lot of Broadway, some swing tunes, kind of stuff like that is really what we have kind of found our niche, you know, as far as that goes.
So that is part of your identity as
yes,
a group.
Yeah.
Do you see yourselves at all transitioning to doing this full time? You teach.
And yeah. You know, there's not a lot of barbershop quartets who I would say have gone to full time. I mean, there may be some exceptions for, I know
the guys on the Tonight Show.
Right, Jimmy Fallon. There you go. Yeah, and there's been, you know, a few cases here or there where quartets have kind of made it for a while at least, or maybe can do enough shows to kind of keep it going for a while. But I think for the most part, barbershoppers kind of have a day job as well and kind of can just use it as a hobby. So yeah, I don't intend on making it a full-time thing.
Maybe that helps you keep it fresh.
Yeah, I think so. We all just enjoy it as kind of a hobby. And honestly, we're all four of us were musicians in college as well. So it's almost, I kind of look at it as partial hobby and also kind of part of my career as well, as far as just an extension of my career as a music teacher, is also being able to kind of sing professionally as well is a nice thing to add to, you know, teaching music.
That's Tim Beitel from the vocal group After Hours. I'm Laura Kennedy.
After Hours, this year's International Quartet champion. You're listening to Heavenly from their third place performance last year.
Your eyes, they shine. Your beauty always satisfies. And that's what makes you so,
oh, so divine.
Baby, you're so fine. Gonna make you mine. They took the moonlight out of the skies. They put the moonlight right in your eyes.
Your eyes.
Like a cherry's dyed.
You're a heavenly thing.
Baby, you're a heavenly thing. They took the fragrance. And sprinkled roses all over you, just
like a garden.
Da-da.
You're a heavenly thing.
You're a heavenly thing.
They made a clinging vine. It's your embrace.
It's your embrace. Stars
that shine.
Light like your face. Put together everything. On your lips they put the breath of spring.
And then
they finished, called it a day.
They took
the model and threw it away.
Like an ancient
Dada,
you're a heavenly thing.
Yeah,
they made a clinging vine.
Your embrace,
stars that shine,
light
your face.
Light it up and to combine everything that
bums
the
bum,
but
yes, the breath
of spring now. And then they finished, they called it a day, and they took the model, threw it away. And I'll tell you something, I'm happy that you're mine. You're so heavenly, baby, and you're mine, you're my angel divine. Yeah, you're so fine.
GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care. Heritage has been offering specialized health care services to seniors in Bloomington Normal for more than 50 years. On the web at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an unusual subject for video games. Here's a story that cuts against the grain of traditional heroic myth and gender roles. This one from Livingston Counties. It's the story of a Civil War soldier who, like many, fought for the Union cause. This soldier, though, was keeping a secret. Tara McClellan and McAndrew spoke about it with IPR's Sean Crawford.
We're talking about a person who went by the name of Albert Cashier. Who are we talking about here?
Albert, to this day, is a mystery, as I talk about in the story. Most people, when you think of Albert Cashier, think of the Civil War soldier who fought for Company G of the 95th Regiment of the Illinois Infantry for 3 years during the Civil War. Albert was, what we know for sure, born in Ireland, and then it's kind of fuzzy, frankly, until about 1862 when Albert showed up in Sonneman, Illinois as a handyman and enlisted in the war, and we know fought for 3 years, was known for his bravery, and much later, decades later, was discovered to be a woman.
This was a secret that was able to be kept throughout all of that time in the Civil War, and we're talking about close quarters, working with other soldiers, living with other soldiers. And apparently nobody was aware of it.
Exactly, which from our modern perspective, we find hard to believe, right? So when I was interviewing some of the experts about this, and I talked to three historians, and specifically one has studied in great detail Civil War women soldiers. They've all written books related to this topic, if not directly on this topic. And one of them said that from our modern perspective, thinking of modern armies who have to go through very in-depth, intimate physical exams to be admitted, That wasn't the case back then. There were virtually no physical exams. In essence, you go to the office to enlist. A person looks at you for what they can see might be an impediment, like a missing limb. Do you have a cough that could indicate tuberculosis? And that might be the full extent of your physical exam. And at the time, too, remember that there were a lot of underage boys who were enlisting. And so a woman who was disguising herself as a man could have easily passed for an underage boy. Now, the question, so we have two questions here. One is, how the heck did they get through the enlistment part? Well, it was easier than we think. Plus, there were no identifications back then to identify you as male or female or even verify your address, say. No social security cards, no birth certificates. That made it easier. But how do you get by with being a woman disguised as a man once you're in the field, literally 24/7, with your regiment? Well, that appears to be easier than we think, too. According to the experts I interviewed, the soldiers did not fully undress in front of each other typically. They relieved themselves in the woods alone. There was no dressing room, so to speak. Actually, it wasn't as hard as it appears to us from our modern perspective.
So Albert Cashier is able to go through the Civil War, gets out of the army, but as you mentioned, continued to live this life for many years. And then how was it discovered that Albert was actually a woman?
It was about 50 years after Cashier had been mustered out of service for the Civil War that he was working for, I couldn't tell if it was a former or a current state senator named Ira Lish. And he was working on a car for Lish. And there was an accident of some sort. It sounds like maybe the car ran over his leg and broke it, and he had to have a physical exam. And the doctor who did that discovered the secret that he had been born a woman. And he begged the doctor, the story goes, and his employer, Lish, to please keep it a secret. And they allegedly did. He was very disabled at this point, and Lish, his employer, helped him get into the Illinois Soldiers and Sailors Home at Quincy. Lish asked the officials there to also keep the gender a secret, like Cashier requested. But it did get out, and once it got out, it spread throughout the country. There were a number of articles done about Cashier being a woman who fought in the Civil War, and they were printed by newspapers everywhere.
But it turns out from the research that you've done and talked with others that this was not the only case of this happening, that there is an estimate of hundreds of women actually serving during the Civil War.
Exactly. The current estimates are somewhere between 500 to 1,000 women, disguised as men, of course, fought for both the North and South during the Civil War. But we will never know how many exactly there were because historians are convinced that there were women who disguised themselves as men and were never discovered. Unlike Cashier. One thing that I found very interesting about this story is the reception that Cashier received and other women received who worked for the armies during the Civil War in a variety of capacities. And the reception that the public gave them could vary. One of the experts I talked to, Deanne Blanton, who is an expert on 19th century army records at the National Archives, she commented about this.
Most women soldiers, if they were confronted by what they had done, they were very, very quick to say that they did it for love. Love of a man. I went with my husband. I couldn't bear to be away from him. Or I loved my country so much. You know, women who said they did it for love it tended to get sort of a pass.
So I guess a question would be, is it fair to say that Albert Cashier was transgender as we know it today?
That's an excellent question. And what one historian whom I interviewed, who also studies gender studies, said is, by definition, Cashier is transgender because Cashier voluntarily lived for the majority of his life as a gender other than his biological gender, which was female. Some of the others say, well, we will never know for sure because we can't ask Cashier, why did you do this? Did you do it so that you would have more economic opportunities that weren't available to you as a female? We won't know that for sure. But if you go by that strict definition of someone who lives their life other than the gender that they've been assigned at birth, Cashier fits that pretty neatly. He spent, at minimum that we know, about, would it be 50 years as a man when he was born a woman.
Tara McClellan McAndrew wrote about the story of Civil War soldier Albert Cashier for Illinois Issues. She spoke with Sean Crawford.
And I feel so lonesome. You hear me when I'm on. And I feel so lonesome. You hear me when I'm on. I've been driving my turf plant for you since I've been gone.
What looks like journalism these days sometimes isn't. At GLT, we answer to listeners, not advertisers or corporations. Listeners help pay for news and the reporters who cover the facts. Eric Stock, a 27-year news veteran covering Bloomington Normal.
Contributor to the recent spike in gun violence.
Mary Cullen, her last beat, the Statehouse.
Frontier Airlines is coming back to Central Illinois.
Independent, financially supported by listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Heil Group, performance consultants whose support for learning and performance management helps organizations engage employees' best thinking and turn their ideas into lasting change. Details at heilgroup.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, GLTs grow. When you think of video games, you are probably thinking big guns, spacesuits, maybe hot rod cars, possibly tanks. But farm tractors? Nah, not so much. And yet, last month, a group of gamers collectively held their breath, waiting to find out what will be the new thing in their favorite video game. IPR's Michelle O'Neill reports players from all over the world were thrilled with a big reveal and a YouTube trailer for the next version of Farming Simulator.
Oh, no, it's got yellow rims. It's green. Oh, my God. John Deere.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Nein.
A company based in Germany called Giants Software developed Farming Simulator, which for the first time will feature John Deere agricultural equipment.
John Deere.
John Deere.
Oh my gosh. John Deere. John Deere.
See, I told you.
Okay, okay.
This video trailer features an 8400 series tractor. PR and marketing manager Martin Robble says fans of the game have been asking for John Deere equipment for a long time, but it takes a long time to persuade large manufacturers to jump on the proverbial bandwagon.
In the industry, we have it sometimes that, you know, when we talk with these brands like John Deere or other brands, we talk with them at conventions, and we had these cases where, for example, the marketing manager of one of the brands comes to us and says, so how can we be in your game? Because my son plays your game, and he always asks me, Dad, why aren't all your products in the game? So he tells us, like, how can we be in there? So that is like the easy case for us.
Giant Software worked with Deere to make sure Farming Simulator 19 gets all the details right, from appearance to performance down on the virtual farm.
American players, the players from the U.S., they really prefer like the big machines because you have really huge fields in the U.S. And then in Europe, there are a lot of players who actually prefer like the smaller tractors because you have small fields and they want to play realistically like how they would play at home. So they can't really use the biggest machines all the time. So it's like, you know, we have to kind of, you know, provide a game for both communities there.
Later this summer, Robble says the company will reveal what other John Deere machines will be featured in the updated version of the game.
What I heard is that apparently people are writing emails and calling John Deere now asking them what's going to be in our game. And it looks like they're getting so many emails that they try to ask us, like, what's going to be in the game? Or basically, can we tell them what's going to be in the game? And then no, please don't. We want to kind of keep it a secret until summer. To be honest, we also want to show them, like, nicely, not just say, like, this is going to be in the game, this isn't going to be in the game. That's why we made this trailer, too, because we wanted to kind of give people goosebumps when they see the first John Deere in the game.
I'd say Robble and Giant Software certainly succeeded based on the reactions of these YouTubers and fans of Farming Simulator. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Never before. Farming Simulator.
I'm completely shocked. They have done
Giant Software will release Farming Simulator 19 in the fall.
Nein! Das ist nicht in ihr Ernst!
Doch, ein bisschen geil. Extrem geil, muss ich ehrlich sagen.
Boys, we just saw deer in the game. We just saw deer in the game. Holy crap.
Nein, JD wird es nicht in LS geben. Die haben ihr eigenes Spiel. Nix da. Giants ballert einen JD in ihren Trailer.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up next is the Something Brothers. The music returns. John Norton has a report. Battery technology has come far enough that landscapers, amateur and pro, can begin to think about leaving gasoline-powered yard tools behind. GLT's Mike McCurdy has more in this edition of our gardening program, Grow.
Just about everything you can do with a gasoline-powered tool in the garden can be handled by a quieter, cleaner, battery-powered electric tool. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and the curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for coming by.
Mike, nice to see you.
On today's Grow, we're talking gadgets, specifically electric gadgets, no cords. I've cut through my share of cords. Have you cut through cords before with like hedge trimmers?
I have. I've done it in the house and outside the house. And
it startles me every time. They're always plugged into GFI outlets, so nobody gets hurt, but it's like bzz.
I know, and that's always a frightening occurrence to encounter that and to discover that you've made that accident.
No cords with these devices, though, that we're
talking
about.
Yeah, and you touched on a couple of the biggest selling points, and that is the emissions. There's virtually none. And if you've ever worked in a commercial groundskeeping kind of setting, or you have a large piece of property, and you've been operating a string trimmer for a while, it's like holding a toaster oven under your arm after a while.
And you have the exhaust.
Yeah, exactly. That too. And, Mike, you have the vibration, the intense vibration of hanging on to a string trimmer that's maybe old or out of balance. It's a trifecta of misery.
So do these work in a commercial application, or are we really talking about, you know, home landscaping?
I think that there are some applications that are commercially friendly, and I think about my travels in the Southeast, and I've actually seen tool rigs, that's the big trailer that they pull behind the vehicle, with solar panels on them. And I thought, well, what's the solar panel for? Well, the solar panel was for a computer that helped the crew stay on their route, and it also kept the owner of that vehicle and trailer aware of where they were at all times. Now, that's an excellent gadget.
Sure.
No stopping for a two-hour lunch at Casey's or whatever. And another thing that's really big in the Southeast and other parts of the country where the landscaping happens 12 months of the year, it's best to do that work early in the morning. A lot of times those guys are driving down the road at 0:30 and they're folding stuff up a little bit after lunch. And then that vehicle can sit there and charge a solar panel and it sells. I know that DeWalt has a kit that includes a multi-tool exchange that's all fueled by one battery. And I have a string trimmer out of that complement, and not having to breathe the exhaust, like you said, is just enormous benefit.
And I have the Ryobi set, which
great product.
So it's all one battery, and it works across all of their tools. So I have the leaf blower, the string trimmer, the hedge shears, and a 10-inch chainsaw, which is great for small jobs
right
around the house. You're not going to be able to cut down a big tree with this thing or do firewood or anything, but it does get the job done.
Right. You might not be able to make a living with it, but you can take care of your own property, and they're quite affordable. And then I think about the options if you have, say, a large home or if you had a home with detached areas, so if you had like a boat dock, or you had a little shed where you kept your golf cart and your golf clubs, this battery-powered stuff is fantastic because you could actually have more than one set. I think that that's a great benefit of the affordability and renewability of that battery-powered equipment.
And we're talking about everything from hand shears, as I mentioned, to chainsaws, even lawnmowers. But some of those batteries aren't interchangeable or work across all platforms. They're more like what you might get in a car.
Right. But I think that because there's changes in how we approach our lawns, I think lawns are going to get smaller because we have to conserve water. And that battery-powered lawnmower is probably going to make a couple of evolutions, and then they'll meet in the middle at a perfect spot, hopefully.
So there are some trade-offs here. What are the benefits, do you think, of going all battery-powered?
The first one that I think of is kind of a toss-up between the limited stress on yourself and the limited stress on the environment. The quiet one, I think your neighbors are going to love you for that, too, if you're the eager beaver that's getting started at 7:30 or 8 on a Saturday. They're very quiet, too. So all of those things make for a more harmonious presence while we're outside working in our gardens and everything.
So the downside of going all electric with batteries has to be the battery.
And your ability to charge it between uses. So that's kind of why I'm of the opinion that you might struggle making a living with it if it's something you needed to use day after day. But I have never had a problem with keeping my stuff charged up. And that could just be attention to detail. But I've also, like you, I've used mine to the end of its life. So even the vacuum cleaner that we have in the house is a battery-powered vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it acts the same way. It just uses its battery up, and then it's done.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of these new batteries is that there's not this slow decline in power. These lithium-ion batteries sort of work at full power until they don't have any more to give, and then the device just stops working.
And there's plenty of people that, for whatever reason, the preference and taste issue, they might not want to mow during the heat of the day. Let it charge back up during the heat of the day, and if you didn't finish your project, maybe you could knock it out there at sundown.
So another downside are the batteries themselves. At some point, the tool may actually outlive the life of the battery. What do you do with the battery? I assume you can recycle them.
Well, here in Bloomington Normal, they have hazardous disposal opportunities during the year, and I believe that they're managed through the Ecology Action Center here in Bloomington Normal. But I know lots of communities have these opportunities to dispose of hazardous waste, not just our old batteries and all kinds of batteries, not just the big batteries that fit into the power tools we're talking about, but the ones that are in the flashlight, the ones that are in the remote, as well as any unused Roundup. You want to get rid of that. Unused paint, all that stuff goes to the same spot. The same people help manage its disposal.
And then you could also call the local battery shops that they might take some of the recycled batteries as well.
Yeah, and I think that that's an industry that's going to evolve also, because I've met people in my life that started businesses collecting rare minerals and circuit boards out of old electronics. A lot of the components that make up the batteries are reusable, but I just think that that's a capitalist opportunity.
Yeah, that's not a do-it-yourselfer thing,
though,
because some of those
not.
Chemicals and breaking into some of those batteries can be hazardous.
Yeah.
Is it helpful to store the batteries inside instead of a sub-freezing garden shed all winter?
Absolutely. My understanding, too, is it's not good to leave those or any other battery laying on bare concrete. So if you had a station in the house where you had like a toolbox or something, if it's a metal toolbox and it rests on the floor with that battery in there, you could conduct through the contact. The way to get around that is have a wood or a piece of carpet or a piece of rubber or something like that at the bottom where that battery is going to rest. And it's always best to not only to avoid letting them get freezing cold, but you don't want them to get smoking hot either.
So is there an upper, if it's 110 degrees outside, there are going to be very few people actually using a string trimmer, I would hope.
Yeah, but I think of how easily it could happen, right? So say I'm coming over to your house to help do some little garden party in preparation for some entertaining you're doing, and we get sidetracked, and that string trimmer's in the back of my pickup truck cooking in the sun. What you might find is that it just doesn't work while it's very hot. And once it resumes normal temperature and the battery stabilizes, it might work again.
Just like my iPhone.
Yeah, it is like that,
yeah,
too.
It'll shut down for a while until it cools off.
And, I overlooked another detail related to your question about, what are some of the cons? One of the cons is, say with the lawnmower, you're getting a 20 or 22-inch cut out of that gas-powered, out of the battery-powered mower. You're getting that large of a cut or larger with the fuel-powered mower. So you might have to take smaller bites, but I think that homes and yards and everything are kind of shrinking at some level. So I think that there's a good meeting in the middle there, too.
And less maintenance?
Less maintenance, for sure.
That doesn't mean no maintenance, but you don't have a gasoline-powered engine to maintain.
That's right. And you don't have filters to change, oil to change. And when it comes to your battery-powered stuff, you can use the blower before the battery runs out to clean off all the other tools.
If you have any questions about tools or anything in the garden, you can submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about irrigation, specifically lightweight irrigation kits. Do-it-yourself kits, Murph, is that what we're talking about?
They are, yes.
All right, that's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find past episodes and subscribe to the Grow Podcast at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Something Brothers guitarist Ed Pierce says it was surprisingly easy for band members to create and record new music together after a nearly 30-year studio hiatus and missing a key band member. A reunion performance last year by the legendary Bloomington Normal Band has now morphed into the group's first album since the early 1990s. The 10-song Apollo was released in June. Group members Ed Pierce and Scott Wilson reviewed the album with John Norton in the GLT studio. Pierce says it was like getting back on a bicycle.
Yeah, I mean, it comes naturally to us. I mean, honestly, it really, if we got one gift, is we're able to, you just see it, you just hear it, and you go, that's it. And I don't know why, but there's some kind of an intuitive thing that we have.
It was pretty spooky, actually, like when we first got into the practice rehearsal space and started fleshing out these songs. It just was so weird how it just felt like it hadn't been 30 years. It seemed like we were just in the studio together 5 months ago.
So, yeah, for instance, a lot of my things, because I've been playing bass guitar a lot, came in as bass demos. Tommy's didn't come in as electric guitar stuff. He came as an acoustic. I'd listen to his thing as an acoustic, and I'm going, I'm not so quite seeing the vision quite yet. And then Scott would go put the lyric to it, and then we'd get the electric guitars on, and all of a sudden it went from a nice kind of acoustic song to one hell of a rock song. So,
well, can you give me an example of one song? Can you think of one
Yucca
song?
Yucca Flat was
Yucca
one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like an acoustic.
Yeah, you know, the riff was on acoustic, everything was on acoustic, and then when it came out to actually flushing it out, it turned out to be a rip-roaring, you know, rock your head off song, which I was shocked, actually, but I was really happy. Set me up.
Yucca Flat is from the new album Apollo by the Something Brothers, their first album in nearly 30 years. But this album, as well as the reunion show last year, was minus one of your key members, Dean Carlson. As you said in a Bandcamp post, fell off the metaphorical van. He's no longer with the band. And my understanding is he is still welcome in the band if he's willing to come back. But let's talk about Dean. Was an integral part of the band. He was up front with Scott as the vocalist. He was with Scott, the primary lyrical writers in the band. How much of an adjustment was it to not have Dean a part of this new album, Apollo?
Adjusting wasn't really actually that difficult. It was unfortunate. He decided he didn't want to do it. We looked at each other and said, well, do we want to do it? We took the leap. We did it. And now we're here. When you look each other in the eye and say, do you really want to do this? And everyone's kind of saying, yeah, I kind of want to do this, then it's a lot easier than having a bunch of people just saying, no, I don't want to do it, or maybe. There was no maybe. It was like, yeah, I want to do this. Yes, I want to do this. So we had five people saying, yes, I want to do this. What do? You go forward.
So maybe the question is for you then, Scott, because you guys played off each other, both lyrically and out front. Was it a difficult transition for you to be the front guy?
It's a little weird. In writing and the studio work, I did what I would normally do. We've only played the one show without him. And Dean and I had kind of a Martin and Lewis kind of thing going, and they both went on to do their own things. But it was one of them deals where, like the humor aspect, Dean was a lot of fun to watch live. Maybe I'm not as energetic on stage as Dean used to be, but you know, it's just, it's a different band. It's a different sound. It's a different thing. we can't really look back and go, what can we do to make this seem more like the old version of this band when it's not the old version of this band anymore?
Well, let's talk about the concept itself. The name of the album is Apollo, and there are numerous references to space, looking down from space, spaceships, right? Earthbound is another one. I mean, there's just all these...
It was weird that way. It's pretty accidental. To tell
it
you
was. And let's play the... Let me be part of Fuzzle, which opens up...
That's the one I was going to make.
Yeah,
hey, down there. Hey, Houston Control. There's a frazzle in the capsule, and I just thought you should know. The spotted craft is glittering gold. There's a bustle in our heads of the road.
Ed had written this demo. His working title was Fuzzle. I always like to use someone's working title as potential lyric jumping off points. And I was asking him what Fuzzle meant. He goes, I have no idea. I was thinking it was just a silly made up word. And I was thinking about how children make silly made up words. And all of a sudden I started thinking about old toys. And my favorite toy of all time was the G.I. Joe space capsule, the Gemini space capsule, you know, that I got for Christmas in 1966 and just went crazy over the thing. And I thought, I'm going to write a song about this space capsule toy, and then it just naturally turned into referencing other toys in it.
We're still spinning like a top, we're headed straight for the center of the soul. The etch sketches up in the red.
And so it's kind of like a song about a kid's version of what it might be like to be in space. He's, you know, he's referencing the
Etch-a-sketch.
The Etch-a-sketch and a spirograph and a kaleidoscope and all these things because he couldn't think of what to call this thing in the capsule that made the retro rockets fire. He goes, oh, I'll just call it an Etch-a-sketch. And so it's kind of just about this kid, a child in space.
You want to hear something dorky?
Absolutely.
My imagination is that you guys are rock gods, right? And you've been off the scene for 30 years or so, and this is your re-entry into the music scene.
Yeah. They're just as good as anything.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Well, and as some of the other songs started almost accidentally having these references, we thought, well, let's just kind of go with that. There probably was a few other songs that I thought, okay, well, let's do another one with some kind of space theme, and then I... wrote Apollo.
I think Scott actually captured the probably his best vocal ever, and I think it's on Apollo. Every time I hear that, I really listen to his voice and just go like, holy crap, this is Scott at his top of his game.
When's the mission to Mars? I steal a ride in a baggage car. I'll be out of my brain on the 550.
That vocal just comes off sincere. It just sounds sweet. I was like, wow.
I quit smoking, too. Which might have something to do with
it. When did the smoking quit?
That's pretty recent.
I'd gone about 6 or 7 months, like, before we made the record, because I knew that that would probably be a really good time to maybe get these old lungs in shape.
Scott Lee Wilson, Edwin Pierce of the Something Brothers in studio. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Great new album. It's called Apollo. It is out. They're going to be featuring songs at their performance in September at the Castle Theater, but that's still a couple of months off as we're speaking here.
September 7th.
Okay. Love Lens. Is that an older song?
It is, yeah. We started playing that one toward
the very end. But
maybe like in 1990.
It's that old.
Yeah, it's a little different than it used to be.
Okay.
We kind of rethought some of the lyrics and we rethought just the feel of the song.
Let me play just a snippet of it then here.
I should have known I was bound to die alone. The
What's different now to what it was before?
Well, actually, some of the, I don't want to say effects, but the synthesizer type of thing where we didn't touch anything like that in the past.
Yeah, so Tommy was using a...
Yeah, he's using a Mellotron pedal, and we messed around with some studio keyboard type stuff.
Yeah, Eric Nelson, who recorded the record.
Yeah, props to Eric.
Genius.
Yeah.
Anybody out there that's going to be making a record locally, talk to Eric Nelson at Eclipse Studios. Yeah, this guy.
He really was a key bounce off.
He had about as much to do with the final sound of this record than we did. I mean, he was constantly coming up with ideas. How about if we add this? How about if we do this? How about you change that melody a little bit?
He had some keyboards
to that song and changed the lyrics from being a positive love song to a negative love song.
Well, that's it. It's very bittersweet.
Yeah, it's beautiful and heartbreaking. The guy landing in someone's arms, and then the new version, she lets him fall to the rock.
Why'd you do it that way?
I'm just a bitter old man.
Well, this is great. Something Brothers fans so geeked about this, and I'm one of them. Great album. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for doing the album.
Thanks
for coming in. If you're listening in your car, thanks for the ride.
Earthbound is from the new album Apollo from the reunited Something Brothers band members Scott Wilson and Edwin Pierce join John Norton in the GLT studios. The Something Brothers will perform the new song September 7th with another show in the Castle Theater in Bloomington. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.